So when, no, I can't say that. What will we say then about eternal life? We are living it in a very real sense. It's not when, then, there. It can't be. It's that eternal or eternity is, if I wanted to say now, I couldn't even say that. Simply is. Okay. That's a boundary we will cross. We will all be transgressive in some way there, not by will, but by destiny. And we don't know what we find. And I suggest that the last word is far from being said about that. Now, one of the people I have liked to read a great deal in my whole life, actually, is or much of it, is Joseph Campbell. And I had the good fortune to attend a number of Joseph Campbell's seminars in New York back in the 70s and got to know him a little bit. Even asked his wife once if she thought that I could approach him with the prospect of meeting with him once a month just to talk about mythology. And it took me some time to realize that I was looking for an analyst and not a professor. So anyway, you know his famous book, The Hero of 1,000 Faces. About half of you have read that book. During that, or somewhere in the early pages, he writes this thing. Throughout the inhabited world, in all times and under every circumstance, the myths of humanity have flourished, and they've been the living inspiration of whatever else may have appeared out of the activities of the human body and mind. It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into human cultural manifestation. Religions, philosophies, arts, the social forms of primitive and historic man, prime discoveries, yes, in science and technology, the very dreams that blister sleep boil up from the basic magic ring of myth. Joseph Campbell knew about that form of constructing the world that was built upon imaginal reality, the mythopoetic world. He knew it directly, and he taught about it. And that's why people loved him so much. Students did. In one other place, he wrote, "The latest incarnation of Oedipus and the continued romance of Beauty and the Beast stand this afternoon on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, waiting for the traffic light to change." That is Joe Campbell. And we could add that in their infinite variety, they will be there waiting on the corners of all the streets yet to come in the distant future of the human experiment on the planet. If we believe some futurists, Oedipus and Beauty and the Beast will be stepping out of their space vehicle onto the surface of the moon, then of Mars, to become the first human colonies by the year 2045. Some of you still living will be able to see that. So saying those things, Campbell has plunged us immediately into the archetypal world of the hero, which is exemplified by Tennyson's poem with its mythopoetic imagery. Campbell gives us a guidebook of themes when he describes the, quote, nuclear unit of the monomyth. Here's what the story of the hero is really about. A hero ventures forth from the world of common day, everyday life, into a region of supernatural wonder, not the same kind of place as the world. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. I might add that it's often a very hard victory, but the hero is destined to win. He doesn't know that, but the self knows. And then finally, the hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. That's from the hero book. And then Campbell asked questions which could be questions for our weekend. What is the secret of this timeless vision? Why is mythology everywhere the same beneath its varieties of costume? And what does it teach? Well, if the romantic versions of the story involve usually the youthful heroic figure, male or female, a brave explorer, willing to step over the boundaries that have heretofore been barriers, there is no reason, at least in my mind, at this point, why the elder person cannot pick up the torch of heroic venturing. And indeed, step in all consciousness over the warnings against crossing the lines of smothering convention of belief and behavior, and still bring back boons for her fellow humans. You don't have to be a physical specimen to be a hero. You have to be willing to step over the boundary that for everybody else is controlling and see what is over there. You're going to have to fight with something if you're going to bring back anything useful, and that will be your job to do that. And this prospect leads us again tonight to another archetype, which I will call that of the transgressive spirit. And in later lectures, we're going to come in more detail to this form of psychic energy and to its particular virtues and manifestations. So I'm almost on the threshold of asking you to be lawbreakers. Well, you know, go ahead. Be careful which laws. But think about it. Think about it. There's no reason in life or in the world why that prospect is not open to the elder person. And I will make an argument that it may be especially older to the elder person. It may be that we reach a point where we are not so bound by the conventions and the usages of collective life. And we can say, wait a minute, do I have to do that still? Do I have to think like that? Do I have to construct the world that way? And you'll be surprised in due time by the answer. Well, since we're going to be putting the light of Jungian depth psychological point of view on the dynamics of the process of growing older, I want to speak at least briefly of some of the language and the concepts I'll use to bring us to a common starting point. I've already used some of those. There's an element of play in all we will be speaking of in these few days. And I want to start with an artifact of play. Here it is. This is a wonderful thing. This is not a sphere. It's an image of a sphere. A sphere is an archetype. You will never know the archetypal sphere with your eyes. You will only know the image of the sphere. A sphere is a three-dimensional object, the most perfect object in three dimensions. It's an image of a polygon with an infinite number of faces. If you bounce it, you don't know which face it bounces, but infinite polygons. Well, that's a concept that cannot be represented. So this is an image of the archetypal sphere. And I want to use it to build a model, a Jungian model, of the psyche. Now, I haven't had a dress rehearsal of this in a long time. We'll see how it goes. Let's let the sphere represent the psyche, the whole human psyche that you and I are described by. Now, we know that we have capacity to be a certain person, to have an identity and a history, to have a gender, to have a story. I told you mine, you could tell me yours. And all of those personal things constitute artifacts of a peculiar little bit of the surface of the sphere up here. And this is what I use to represent the ego area of a personality. That's the picture of the ego complex. Not very big, is it? That seems to be the story about the ego. It's a very small piece of psychic life, relatively speaking, with a history that's not all that long, relatively speaking, and each of us has our own. Now, I'm going to give the ego a little camp. And you can guess what that red cap means. You're each in possession of one. And that's a persona. So, small ego needs a persona, a cap, a cover against the world so that the world doesn't intrude too much. Now, I'm going to go down below that and draw, I hope this color coding is reasonable. No, I don't want this one yet. Excuse me. Underneath ego consciousness, I'm going to make a jagged line all around and say there are some things in each personality which are not contained in consciousness so readily. They could be, but somehow they're not there. And typically it's because they had too little energy to be maintained in consciousness, so they simply fall out. Not enough mortar for the bricks. Or they never became conscious before. They didn't ever have enough energy to come up into consciousness. So they belong down in here. Or there may be elements of our personal life that we would choose to forget. We'd like to not have the knowledge of those personal things, maybe that are associated with too much pain. So they get lost, and they fall out of the circle of consciousness and fall into an area we will label the personal unconscious. Now, below that, there's another kind of jagged line somewhere down in here. These are very qualitative pictures, mind you. The size of nothing here makes a big difference. Whoop. There it is. That could have been a neurosis right there. So there is some unconscious material that we definitely don't want to cross the boundary. So that stays down here. But it still remains in the personal part of the psyche. Now, look. It leaves most of the rest of the volume of, or the surface of sphere, untouched. What are we to say about that? Now, as I say, these areas are not to be understood quantitatively, but qualitatively, yes. Small portion of psychic life and energy dedicated to personal identity and consciousness. Rather, a bit more of the unconscious side of life associated with a certain individual. But then below that, underneath that, a massive volume of psychic life. And I emphasize life, because this area underneath is alive. And this, I'm going to call this just, you already know this, the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious, an element or area of unconscious life shared by all of us. We could also call this the archetypal unconscious as well. Now, I don't have a pen that will reach into the center of the sphere, but if I could do that, I would now put a figure right in the middle that has the quality and the property of holding the whole operation together, and that would be the self. This whole area down here is the collective unconscious. All of this huge volume, relatively speaking, now again, and at the center of that is what Jung called the self. Ah. So the implication here is that in the Jungian model of the psyche, the collective unconscious part, the part of life that doesn't even belong to us personally, outweighs everything summed up together that belongs to us in any personal way. Each of us carries all of the accumulated life of the human species from its beginning. Not as a part of who we are, not as a part of I, but a part of we. And that part of psyche is not silent by any means, but is often not very apparent to the ego, this small area on top. We might even say of the self that the self constitutes the center, the central organizing principle, and the totality of the psyche. And the ego complex constitutes the organizing principle of individual consciousness. So it's a little scary to think that we bear at our very essence a psychic content which has nothing to do with us personally, everything to do with humanity, with woman and mankind in the collective. I say to myself from time to time, to emphasize the difference, that this area up here for me has to do with my life. This area down here has to do with life itself. Life itself. And I would say about the unconscious, the deeply unconscious, the collective unconscious psyche, that it is, I've already said this, alive, reactive, observant, concerned, interventionist. It gets into our lives a great deal. I think that's about the most I want to say about this model. It's enough for what we're going to do this weekend. One last thing I might add is that in the personal part of the psyche, the building blocks, the masonry, if you want, the bricks, are composed of personal complexes. See, they're personal. They have to do with my experience. And they are complexes because they operate from mostly an unconscious place. That might include the complex of the abandoned child, or the complex of the greedy merchant, or something again like that that we can define in individual human terms. Well, that's the model we're going to use the rest of the weekend as we talk about it. And I'll keep the ball up here and try to add some little things to it as we go by.